Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
I'm not used to getting this much attention or help. So thanks everybody for coming tonight. I really appreciate it. It's totally true that I had initiated this because I cover Somalia very closely, and I had thought that it would be really interesting to come to a part of the United States where people would understand and care about the issues that I'm writing about. And then I learned about the great literacy here and the potential for book sales. So I really appreciate everybody coming tonight. Let me begin just, it's always kind of strange to hear somebody reading your bio because you think of all the things they don't know about you, which would be much more interesting. But to give you the PG version, I grew up in a Chicago suburb, Evanston, Illinois, and I really wasn't a well-traveled young guy. My parents didn't take us around the world. I had never been to the developing world as a kid. But I had this interest for some reason in going to Africa. And I'm not even sure where that came from. I think it had something to do with the fact that I associated Africa with adventure and that it was this rugged place that I didn't know much about. And I had set my sights on spending some time in Africa after my freshman year of college. I couldn't find any programs. There was very little information available at the time. This was in 1990. And eventually, by a total fluke, I found myself on a road trip with 14 other students driving across sub-Saharan Africa from Nairobi to southern Malawi, because at that time there was a very bad civil war in Mozambique. And the guy who organized this trip was a very special person. His name was Dan Eldon. And his family later published these journals that he made. And some people, from time to time, I run into people who have seen them. And he was killed in Somalia in 1993. And he was a contemporary of mine. But at the time, before this happened, he organized this trip. He was very interested in, he grew up in Kenya, very interested in trying to do something to help people in that part of the world. And he organized this trip to bring students across Africa and to bring medical supplies to the victims of the Civil War. And I was presenting this to my parents in Evanston, and their heads were spinning, and I think my mom called the CDC every day leading up to my departure. But eventually they agreed to let me go on this trip, and I left out the fact that the leader was a 19-year-old college dropout who basically had no idea what he was doing, but had this vision of taking kids across Africa. So that was my introduction. And that summer was like a left turn in my life. I really have no idea what I would be doing now if I hadn't gone on that trip. Because at the time, I just sort of assumed my father was a lawyer, that I would go to law school and become a lawyer, and that I would live in Chicago. I hadn't given it that much thought, but if you pushed me back then, that's what I would have predicted. And that summer, just it really moved me, our experience. And it wasn't so much the helping the refugees or the mission of that trip. It was just the day-to-day interactions we had in East Africa and meeting people who had so much less than anything I had ever witnessed, and seeing people who were literally wearing rags, living in huts where there was nothing in them except maybe a balled up blanket on a dirt floor, seeing kids with no toys except little plastic soccer balls that they make out of plastic bags that they collect that are blowing in the trees or on the grounds, and they pack together really tightly like a snowball and put strings around it. That was the toy. But at the same time, there was immense joy and openness. And I had never been around people that were as kind to me as these people who had nothing. And that just kind of blew me away and made me rethink a lot of what we get caught up in and the values that I had been steeped in Evanston, Illinois. So I came back from that trip with this burning desire to live and work in East Africa. And it was like this inconvenient passion, because nobody at Cornell, where I went to school, my parents, friends, nobody could help me sort of figure out what to do over there. And I studied Swahili at Cornell, and then I started trying to think of what type of career could I do. And my first attempt was to be an aid worker, because that was the most obvious way to access this interest I had and to help people. And I tried it for a summer in Ethiopia, and it was a really tough summer. It was one of the loneliest, most discouraging experiences I've had, where I was working in Addis, the capital. We were trying to help people across Ethiopia. And there was this almost resentment towards us. It was much more complicated giving out aid than I had ever expected, that people didn't, you know, felt patronized and felt their dignity was under assault by us constantly telling them, you know, why don't you do this or do that, or here's the way to dig a latrine, or here's a, you know, condoms to use, you know, when you're having sex. And a lot of this stuff was well-intentioned, but it just wasn't communicated in a way that the people accepted, and the connection between us and the people we were trying to help was really strained. And so I came back from that summer kind of lost, because that seemed like the most obvious route. And I then was struggling to figure out what can I do in Africa. And I put a lot of pressure on myself. I was like a 21-year-old kid that, you know, wanted to do really well professionally and be successful. And I really struggled to figure out the next move. And that's when I seized upon journalism, which at the time was very vibrant. You know, nobody was talking about fake news. Even the terms, it's interesting. So at some point between then and now, the press became the media. And the press had this kind of lofty connotation. Yeah, we had this mission, you know, we were the fourth estate. It conjured up Watergate and episodes in history where journalists were standing up for the right thing. And then somehow we became the media, which sounds like this amorphous, headless blob that's going to, you know, try to take over the world. But at the time, journalism was thriving, but it was really hard still to get a job. And I sent out clips, writing samples, all across the country. I think I even applied. Is it the Star Tribune here? Yeah. Yeah, see, I remember all these names. There's Toledo Blade. All these newspapers across America wanted nothing to do with me. And I had just stacks of rejection letters. And I remember my mother saying, oh, this is what it's like to be an actor. And I was like, well, actors, at least there's some glamour in that. I'm just trying to be a newspaper reporter. And eventually I got exactly one job offer in Central Florida at a newspaper called the St. Petersburg Times. And it actually is a very good medium-sized newspaper. But St. Petersburg was like Manhattan compared to where they had me work, which was a little town in Central Florida called Brooksville. And I was desperate to prove myself. And I found myself covering shootings, stabbings, drownings, car accidents. I was doing the police beat. Anything that passed for news. Our bar was very, very low. I'd go to the jail, and they'd hand me the log, and I would scan it eagerly for any crimes. And then I would go off in my car. And this was like a totally different era. One of our greatest tools was the phone book that we would flick through to find addresses and phone numbers and names. And we had map books to steer us around the county. And I came in to the office one day, and my editor said to me, he said, we want you to go try to find this guy, Willie Crane. And this, I don't know how many people in this room have read the book, but I expand on this in the book, as most of the things I'm going to tell you. So if you want more, buy the book. So I was assigned to do an interview with this man, Willie Crane. And the facts were this. Willie Crane had met a woman at a bar. He was a crab fisherman near Tampa, Florida. And the woman had invited him back to her house. And she said that her back hurt, and he gave her 5 Valium pills, and she fell asleep, and she had a little girl in her house, and when she woke up, the girl was gone, and Willie was gone. And it was pretty clear instantly that he had done something to her, but there was no evidence anywhere of what had happened. And when the woman called the police and said, I brought this guy home and this is what happened, they ran his name and they found out that he had been in prison for raping little girls, the exact same age as her girl, and that he should have been in prison for like 60 years. But at the time, Florida was growing really fast and they were releasing inmates left and right. And this guy got out after like 5 years for something like a 50-year sentence. And so the suspicion immediately was that this man had done something to this little girl. And in local news, these are big stories. It's on the TV every night. Everybody's talking about it. Immediately, there were signs tacked up on trees all over the area with pictures of this little girl. Her name was Amanda Brown. And what was strange about this case is that there was a suspect, but he was on the loose. They had not a scrap of evidence on him. And so there was this interest in trying to talk to him. And he had refused all interviews. So my editor had said to me, hey, why don't you try again to talk to this guy, Willie? So I went to his family business. He was a crab fisherman, was running this little sort of dilapidated shack on Tampa Bay where they sold blue crabs. And the police were looking in his crab traps for the girl. It was a very dark story where they were pulling up these metal crab traps from the bottom of Tampa Bay looking for pieces of this little girl. And so I somehow convinced his daughter to tell me where Willie was, and I show up at his trailer, and I'm like 25 years old. Nobody has taught me anything about how to interview a killer or how to handle myself in a situation like this. Because if you ask too many questions in those early jobs, people are going to wonder, like, well, why'd we give you the job in the first place? So you're sort of faking it. And I knocked on the door of his trailer. He lived in this double-wide, run-down trailer that was kind of sinking into the weeds. And he flings open the door, and he's like, howdy, Jeff. And he's got two black lines drawn on his jugular veins with a magic marker. And I said, Willie, what's, you know, hi, how are you? What are those lines? And he says, if the police want any blood samples, I'm going to give them all the blood they can get, and I'm going to slit my throat. And he has me sit down at a table where he's got an enormous buck knife sitting right at his elbow. So I sit down, and he's denied having anything to do with the girl's disappearance. He's told the police that he left that house, he was sleeping in the bed, he went on his business, and there was no evidence linking him to a crime. But it was kind of obvious that there was no other person that would have disappeared this girl. So I'm trying to make small talk with him. And he was actually, because, you know, I'm nervous and scared and trying to get the big scoop to advance my career. And he's sitting there with this big plate of pork chops, eating them ferociously. And I say, hey, Willie, it looks like you're hungry. And he's like, damn, Skippy, I'm hungry. This is the first meal I've had since that little girl died. And I got like a chill throughout my whole body. And thought, he did it. And I'm sitting in this trailer, he's locked the door, he's got this big buck knife right next to him, and this guy killed this little girl. So I ended up somehow surviving that, doing a big story. It was a big scoop because he had totally tripped up and had indicated that he had killed her. And it ends up that he was convicted of first-degree murder and sent to death row. He's there right now in Florida. And to this day, they have not found a scrap of that girl, except a little blood stain on his underwear that they found in searches of his trailer, the same trailer I was in, that was her blood stain. And that was it. And they convicted this guy of first degree murder, no body, no crime scene. But as a journalist, like, somebody else's misfortune is our gain. And I used that story to get to the LA Times, because it was a big local story. And I then worked in Los Angeles for a couple years, and then September 11th happened. And the instant that news event was so huge, all of a sudden there were opportunities for people like me to go to Egypt, to Yemen, to Afghanistan, to Iraq. I was thrown out into the world. And I had always wanted to go to East Africa. That always remained my goal, even throughout all these adventures. But it got a huge jump start because of this appetite by the American public and by newspapers to figure out what had happened on that day and what does the world really think about us, which we really had. It was like the 90s, we were asleep. And it was this, you know, period after the Cold War where it just seemed like everything was going great. America was the undisputed superpower, and there was no threat against us. And as we all remember, like September 11th just totally changed that. So I spent a lot of time in Iraq, which was a very traumatic experience because it was more murder than it was war. It was covering suicide bombings and walking into to buildings where people had been blown up and people were crying and miserable and blaming the Americans, and just trauma across that country that had been unleashed by the American invasion. Even if it wasn't the American troops that were causing this violence directly, all that had started when Saddam Hussein was pushed out and that country was put into chaos. And so I did that. And then finally, in 2006, I got my dream job, which was to live and work in Nairobi, in East Africa. And I had been waiting years to do this. And it's been a wonderful experience. It's been exactly what I hoped it was. It's allowed me to spend a lot of time in a part of the world that I care a lot about and to shine a light on it. But I'm often torn because what brought me to Africa in the first place was this sense of people being close to each other and connected and that warmth and that spirit. And I even describe to people, for those of you who've never been to that part of the world, even the way people shake hands is different, where somebody will come up and they'll say, "Hi, how are you doing? How's it going? How's the family?" And the whole time, they're holding each other's hand. They don't pull it back, and they just stand there for like 5 minutes talking, like holding hands, shaking hands, right? And there's just a sense of like people sort of pulling for each other more. And you see it in the way they carry bags. You see two people carrying one strap each of a bag going to the bus stop or coming from school. It's just a much more bonded place. So that's what had attracted me to East Africa. But in my job as the New York Times correspondent, I'm often covering conflict. And for those of you who've read any of my stories, that's probably what you've read about rape in Congo or civil war in South Sudan or Kenya's election crisis. And that it bothers me, it troubles me, because I have how I feel about this part of the world, but I also have a responsibility as a journalist. And I get asked, like, how do you choose your countries or your stories, which countries to cover? And there's only one of me. There's one New York Times correspondent in East Africa. I don't really have a staff. It's just me. And I cover 400 million people, 13 different countries. And there are things happening every day that are sort of flooding through my email. I check the wires. I look at other websites. I look at the local news, local newspapers. And I feel a responsibility to cover injustices. I feel like I have a big megaphone working for the New York Times. And I should use that for some good. And so I often find myself writing about really horrible things that I hope by writing about them there's some positive change. For instance, I wrote about the Somali famine just a few weeks ago, because yet again Somalia is in a famine situation. And there are millions of people who are on the brink of starvation, and it's very difficult bringing food in because of this militant group, the Shabab militant group, that's kind of put a ring around many areas of Somalia, and they're blocking food aid. They don't like Westerners. They won't let Western aid organizations work there. And so these people who did not cause this problem at all, it's caused by drought and climate change and problems with farming and food security, are all of a sudden stuck and trapped. And I just did this story, and I had done a very similar story a few years before that. And there's been famines recurring in Somalia for years. And so I'm sort of seeing two storylines from my vantage point in Nairobi of this part of Africa. And one of them is some countries are stuck. and their governments are really bad, and there's a lot of conflict, and there's not really a clear way out. And that's true for Somalia, that's true for Congo, that's true for Central African Republic, that's true for South Sudan. And a lot of the forces that have put these countries in this place, they go way back to colonialism, to the Cold War, where the United States or the Soviet Union dumped tons of weaponry in these places to make them our ally. We supported really bad leaders that robbed these countries blind, and then we just abandoned them in 1990, 1991. When the Cold War ended, we just said, you know what? We don't really care about Somalia anymore. Or we don't really care about Congo anymore. And there's no accident, actually, that the 1990s were among the most violent times in Africa, because that's right when the Cold War ended and the West disengaged. And you had civil wars in Somalia and Ethiopia and Congo and Eritrea and Liberia and Sierra Leone and Rwanda. Like, some of the worst things happened in that period. And it's no accident. So that's one thread that I find myself covering, is these failed states. And my theory is they're going to remain failed, because this idea of a Western nation state never really worked in parts of Africa, and I don't think it's going to come back. It was only held in place by colonialism, where we imposed, you know, we just took these spaces and carved out pieces and said, you know, you guys both may be from the Maasai tribe, but today you're Tanzanian, and your buddy just over there is Kenyan, and, you know, good luck. That's how colonialism operated in a lot of places. And then you had the Cold War, right when Africa was getting its independence, it stepped into the Cold War, like full on, you know, in the early 1960s. All these African countries had fought really hard for independence, and they stepped right into the Cold War, and they were pulled to one side or the other. Soviet Union backing some, United States backing others, with no interest for the Africans, but who would be our allies in that part of the world to block any communist expansion. I mean, it sounds so arcane now, the whole domino theory, but that's what dominated international relations at that period. And Africa suffered immensely. So that's one story, and we're sort of stuck in that. We're stuck in these failed states that were really badly governed, and it's only now when the world is kind of disengaging that we're seeing the results of that. And I think there will be a kind of new system. I think some countries will become almost like city states, where there will be large spaces. Like, I don't see Central African Republic or Libya or South Sudan. I don't see those countries in my lifetime ever being efficiently governed from a capital that controls all that space. I don't think that's going to happen. You're going to have a node of stability, maybe in the capital, maybe in a couple other places, and then these large regions in between that are kind of no man's lands, or controlled by a warlord or a militant group or just nobody. We'll see that in Syria, you know, we'll see that in Yemen. Like, that's going to be the new model. You heard it here first. But at the same time, I think we're seeing another story in Africa, and I see that from Kenya, which is rapid economic growth and new technology and progress in a growing middle class that is very professional, that should encourage a lot of hope. And they're happening at the same time. In Somalia, for instance, it's almost in the same place, because in Mogadishu, the capital, there's a lot of development these days. I've been going back there for years. And when I first got there, all the buildings were full of bullet holes, and the whole city was slowly crumbling. And it was very interesting visually, because Somalia had been sort of brought down by assault rifles and grenades. It wasn't like these big bombs flattened the city like in World War II or some other places. It was small scale warfare over years and years. And so people were still living in these bullet-pocked buildings with no windows and holes everywhere and laundry hanging from a house that looked like it was about to tip over. But since then, that was when I started. Since then, there's been enormous growth, and people are buying these houses and investing in them. And there's a dry cleaners in Mogadishu now, and ATMs, and you know, some things. You see these cultures changing really fast. For instance, in Somalia, it's an oral culture. The Somali language was not written until 1974. Nobody had codified it. They used a little Arabic, maybe they used some Italian. That was the colonial power, but it was never, there was no official written language until 1974. So one effect of that is that you see in Somalia on stores paintings of the inventory of the stores. It's like this cartoonish art form where you go into a pharmacy and you see paintings of a vial of medicine or maybe a skeleton or a microscope, and you go to a car parts store and there's paintings of the mufflers and the carburetors and the shocks, and a restaurant will have paintings of a hamburger, all this like food that looks really good that they often don't have, like hamburger and french fries. And that was this art form that developed to advertise to illiterate people. So now all that's kind of disappearing, like just now, because I saw it just a few years ago. Because there's been development, sign makers have come in. There's plastic banners and computer-printed illustrations. And so we're just seeing these societies turn really fast. But a place like Kenya, where I live, it's dizzying. It's like there's construction sites everywhere. My wife and I were going to meet a couple for dinner like 2 years ago, and we said, let's meet at this Indian restaurant at this corner, you know, on this night, this time. And we got a call from them, and they're like, yeah, that night, they were on the early side, and I was a little late, and they said, we're in front of that place you told me, but all we can see is like a big fence. And like within a couple weeks, a place that we had just been had been razed to the ground and was being developed into like a mall. And you're seeing that. There's like no interest in historical preservation, which is really sad because some of these places do have some very beautiful old buildings dating back to a different era, and they're just getting knocked down, you know, as we are in this room right now. So that story, I mean, there are, of course, like there's pollution and there's traffic and, you know, there's the gap and inequality is growing because some people are getting very rich. But the overall trend is good. In most ways. People have more disposable income. Children are going to school. Fewer people are dying of diseases like malaria or cholera. Really easy diseases to prevent. Still, like every year, 1 million kids in Africa die from a mosquito bite, from malaria, still to this day. But if there wasn't these advances in modern medicine, it would be millions of kids. But there are some some things that are not being managed well, and we see it in like Kenya. Wildlife is a really big is a big concern now because as these countries are growing, they need more food, they need more energy, they need more, you know, more housing developments, more roads, and so you're seeing these pristine areas just being turned into suburbs. And there's now issues in Nairobi with lions escaping from the national park and attacking people in urban Nairobi because urban Nairobi has now grown and attached itself to these areas that were wild just a few years ago. And elephants need a lot of space. And there's these debates of, well, should we set aside land just for wildlife or should we farm that land because we need the food, we need the jobs. And I have a big story that's going to run, hopefully in the next few days or week or so, that I've already worked on, about land issues, because land is going to be a big problem in Africa. We think of sub-Saharan Africa as just these endless vistas, wide open space. You go on safari, you just can't believe how open and raw and beautiful it is. But there's immense pressure on land, and the population is growing very fast. Part of it is cultural, that many African families had a lot of kids in the past because kids would not survive. So if you wanted 4 or 5 children, you'd have 7 or 8 children because half of them were going to die from malaria or cholera or something like that. That's now changed. If you have 7 or 8 children, 7 and 8 children are going to survive. And so family sizes are really big, and the population projections for Africa, it's going to be something like 4 billion people by the end of the century. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on land because African, there's not that, there, even though Nairobi's industrializing and places like South Africa and Kenya have some industry, it's tiny compared to most of the continent. If you look at a map of Africa at night, you know, those maps you see of the world at night, and Europe is bright, and the United States, the coasts are really bright. Minneapolis is bright. But there's large spaces that in Africa that are just dark. There's very little, you know, industry. And so these people are wedded to the land. And they're going to, right now, agriculture accounts for something like 60 or 70 or even 80% of people's livelihood and employment. So unless there's some solutions made, there's going to be real problems. And we're already seeing it. We're seeing the average farm size. You know, people used to have a farm of like 10 acres. And they'd give it to their, you know, five sons or four sons. And they each would get, you know, 2 acres. And now those sons are having five kids. And those kids are having five kids. Or eight kids. And so those pieces are now getting really small. And at the same time, you have climate change, which is really sad because sub-Saharan Africa produces almost none of the world's pollution. If you look at the contributors to the greenhouse gases, global warming, Africa is like tiny sliver, tiny bit, because most of it is not industrialized. So, but at the same time, Africans are going to suffer from the effects of global pollution. And there's millions of people that live in this band that's right on the edge of fertile and infertile, right on the edge of arid land. And they're going to get tipped over into desert areas with a couple degrees of warmth, which is predicted. And that's going to create a lot of insecurity and even greater pressure on land. So I'm hopeful for some parts of the continent. I think I've seen in just my own experience in 10 years in Nairobi, so much change for the better, and it happened really fast. You feel like Africa is joining the world. But I do think there are deep problems in some of these countries. And that was part of the reason why I wrote this book, is I wanted to go beyond the news stories. I wanted to share like a fuller picture that's pretty difficult to share in a newspaper column of a certain length. And to make it personal, because I think that's what would draw people in. I was like this clueless, you know, 18-year-old kid in Evanston, Illinois, and I got very closely attached to this part of the world. And I think for anybody who comes and visits us in Kenya, friends or family, they leave thinking, okay, I get it. I see why you guys, you know, care about this part of the world. It's a very special, beautiful part of the world. So with that, I would love to take your questions, and I really appreciate you guys listening to my spiel. And thank you for coming tonight.
Okay, karibu sana.
Asante sana.
You know, Jeff Hutchins speaks very fluent Swahili. I can actually put some native speakers to shame. So, karibu sana. And that was quite an inspiring talk.
Thank you.
And, you know, this discussion, we're going to actually rely mostly on your questions. I'm not going to do much talking here. But while I wait for the questions to come, I do have a couple that kind of set the stage for tonight's discussion. You know, I kind of want to get a sense of how you deal with the two Africas that you just mentioned up here. Because as a person, I noticed that, you know, I've been following, I read your stories, obviously, the two major New York Times correspondents, you know, there's you and there's Dion over in West Africa. And there seems to be this struggle. Most times, the coverage is dominated, obviously, but with the other Africa that you just mentioned, which is the wars, like in Somalia, South Sudan. So how do we balance this to see if we can get more positive stories of Africa, for example, from people like you?
Can you guys hear me? Is this working? It's really difficult because journalism tends to focus on the disastrous and the dramatic and the exceptional. You guys have never read a story about a million mothers sensibly raising their children. You've never read that story. You will not read that story. You might read a story about a mother drowning her kids or a mother doing something really bad to her kids. So that's like, for better or for worse, where everybody in this room like is drawn at some level to these kind of dramatic disaster stories. That's what you look for when you turn on the TV. That's for some reason, human beings want to hear about these horrible things happening or the exceptional things. So it's hard. You know, whether it's in the United States or anywhere, I think news tends to be focused on that. But that's not an excuse to misrepresent anything. And so you have to be conscious. And I try to balance out my reports with travel stories, with feature stories, with stories about athletes, or stories about, you know, economic progress. But it's hard, because I feel this responsibility that I was mentioning, that if I know about something really bad happening, and, you know, there's some people in this room from Kenya, from Congo, you know, two very different countries. And that's another thing, like, we often talk about Africa as one place. It's not. It's 54 different countries with different stories within them. But there are similarities. There are common experiences between African countries because of these forces like colonialism and the Cold War. But for instance, in Congo, there's almost no, you know, the local media is not great. And they're not free. And they will get hunted down if they write some critical stories about the president of Congo. Kenya, the media is pretty good. But even I detect some self-censorship. Where they don't want to cover a story that's too hot, too close to the president, or the people in power, because they could get killed, or thrown in jail, or lose their business. So I think, like, as a Western reporter, I don't have like a savior complex. You know, I'm just one guy trying to do my best. But sometimes if I don't write the story, nobody will write the story.
So is the pressure from New York, or is it you can kind of determine, hey, you know, this is what I'm going to, yeah, there are some parameters that, your editors in New York have given you that, hey, you know, we want this, or is it pretty much up to the bureau chief to decide?
It's pretty much up to me. I mean, that's part of the job, is they trust me to read the landscape and decide what's a story. But I put that pressure on myself because, like I say, you know, I've written stories about, let's say, mass rape in Congo, or a massacre by the LRA in Central African Republic, or corruption. Somebody tonight said something about a story I did about corruption in Congo. And if I didn't do that story, you know, there's not that many other Western journalists. Like, my job is kind of an old-fashioned job. And we are competing against, you know, the Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and all these different websites that will write the occasional story in this part of the world from New York or San Francisco. And I have this like old-fashioned job where I set off, you know, with like $5,000 in my pocket or 10,000 bucks, and I go to these places where it's like all cash economy, and I hire a truck and a translator or a dugout canoe, and I go into the interior, and I have my notebooks and my satellite phone, and my mosquito net and my suntan lotion, and my granola bars, and I try to get as close as I can to the real story. I was just in a rural part of Congo, Bandaka, like upriver, very hard place to get. I spent thousands of dollars buying fuel for a dugout canoe, this like log that was 60 feet long that we just packed with supplies, and we went way up the river, the Congo River, into these places that were totally untouched, working on a wildlife story about apes, you know, very rare species of apes being hunted down, either to kidnap, to sell to people in zoos illegally, or to kill them for their meat, because in a lot of these areas there's not many sources of protein, and people are going to eat whatever they can, including these very endangered animals. So just the logistics of doing a trip like that are exhausting. But that's why I get annoyed when I hear about fake news, because this is like the antithesis of fake news. But there's not many other people doing it. There's not many other big media left doing that. It's kind of an anachronism. When I wanted to get into this business, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, the LA Times, all these sort of mid-tier papers had correspondents in places like Kenya or Africa. They don't. So if I don't write a story about some of these topics, it's, you know, it really might not ever get out there. And so when I hear about an injustice or atrocity or a wildlife problem, yeah, you might read that story and be like, wow, that's really discouraging and sad, they're killing apes. But that's an important story to write, because it will put some pressure on wildlife groups or the governments to do more.
Okay, now, you know, the New York Times, for example, has expanded their digital offerings now. So, you know, they have a much bigger platform now than, let's say, during the era of just the print newspaper. So do you see any opportunities maybe, granted that it's just you for East and Central Africa, do you see more opportunities? Maybe there might be more expanded coverage, or you don't think that's going to happen?
Maybe a little bit, but what I think is also happening is news is becoming more democratized. Because of social media, you don't need somebody like me to go into Congo or to go to Mogadishu or go to Nairobi, because you're seeing people on their own tweeting or posting on Facebook. In a way, like, everybody's a journalist now. And that creates a lot of noise. And I think there will always be a premium, I hope, on somebody to analyze and filter that noise, because you know, there's just so much coming at you now that you need somebody. You're paying. That's what you're paying. You're paying somebody at the New York Times to go through all that for you, and sort it. And so I think there's going to be a lot of other forms of information.
Okay, so you know you're going to get your wish here. You know, you said you wanted to come to Minnesota because there's a large Somali population here, and the questions I'm seeing here right now, they're all revolving around Somalia right now. Okay, so
bring it on.
So first of all, before there's one that one of the questions is asking, with the new administration, with the I'm paraphrasing. I'm not going to read word by word what you just wrote, but. With the new administration we have now in Washington, the focus is America first. Already, as you know, the United States are pretty much withdrew from Somalia completely. Do you see, and I know they have been kind of supporting the African Union forces with resources and stuff like that. Do you see Americans getting involved again? I know you just wrote a story on the latest involvement of American forces, but what can you, from your vantage point in Nairobi, see happening in Somalia right now, with especially in relation to the current new administration?
We've really screwed Somalia up, and I've written about this, and I go into it in some depth in the book. If you look back, and it's not always malevolent, it's just poorly thought out. So if you look back at how the U.S. got involved in Somalia in 1992 and then 1993, we had this kind of naive belief that we could just come in and bring food and distribute it and they'd love us. Sounds familiar, right? And everything would be peaceful. And we did very little to stand the state up. And so it was quickly apparent that it was going to be hard to effectively intervene in Somalia without some type of government structures. And it's Somalia, I've written a lot about Somalia. It's interesting. So the northern part of Somalia was called Somaliland and was a British colony. The southern part was called Somalia, was an Italian colony. At independence in the early 60s, they joined together to form the nation of Somalia. The British didn't really do much in northern Somalia, Somaliland. The British had dozens of colonies all around the world. And Somaliland was just like kind of an afterthought. The Italians had like three colonies. They had Libya, Eritrea, and Somalia. And they poured lots of resources, turned the government, made their own government, really invested in Somalia, but also disrupted Somalia. And in 1991, when the government collapsed, the northern part actually was very quiet because the British had not upset the local nodes of authority. They had used indirect rule, kept the elders in place, the religious sheikhs, and those guys, when the government just disappeared, maintained some stability. Southern Somalia, there was all that had been wiped away by the Italians, and so the place just went into chaos. And the U.S. didn't sort of appreciate this history and came in as an outside force, and we had the Black Hawk Down disaster, and then we pulled out, like, immediately after that. 1,000 Somalis were killed on that day, 18 Americans, that was enough, we were out. And then Somalia sank deeper into chaos. And the Rwanda genocide was a direct result of this, because after America felt like they got burned in Mogadishu and the genocide started in Rwanda, they said there's no way we're getting involved in another African country. And that would have been so much easier, because there were these death squads with clubs and machetes that killed 1 million people. actually more people were killed in Rwanda during those 3 months of genocide than Nazi Germany had killed the Jews at the height of the Holocaust. The death rate on the streets of Rwanda was that high, with clubs and machetes. And that was like a huge mistake. And these guys, Bill Clinton and Susan Rice and others, have said so since, that they regretted not getting involved in Rwanda, but they felt so burned. So the world neglected Somalia for many years, and it only got interested again in 2006 when this Islamic group took over. And this is like a long way to answer the question, but since, you know, this is a part of the country where there's a lot of Somalis, it might help just to understand like why we're at where we're at. And this Islamic government was actually much more moderate than we gave them credit for. And they weren't necessarily these like crazy bearded radicals that wanted to, you know, start a Taliban-like state. I went there early on in their administration. And I had this, you know, people were calling them the African Taliban. And I got there expecting to see the African Taliban. And instead I saw boys and girls in school right next to each other. I saw people helping out cleaning up the streets. I saw signs of the state trying to come back. And these guys were eager to talk to me. They were eager to talk to the American government. And they were using Islam for a very practical reason, which was totally underappreciated. And that was, Somalia is one of the most homogenous countries on the planet. Every baby born in Somalia speaks Somali language from birth, which is very few countries besides some little drops of sand in the Pacific Ocean are like that. It's a very homogenous country. Same language, same ethnicity, same race, same religion. But it's very divided by clan. These clans are lineage groups. Everybody looks the same, they speak the same language, but their ancestors are different. And hundreds of years ago, they split off their family trees, and that's what they mean by clan. And so the Islamists that took over Somalia in 2006, they had the first idea, it seems very obvious. They said, let's unite everybody with religion. It's one of the few things that unites all these different clans. And they did that, and there was a lot of support, and the United States immediately saw a threat, and covertly, with the CIA and the Pentagon, backed the Ethiopian government to invade the country. Ethiopia is a traditional enemy of Somalia. Ethiopia is mostly a Christian country, different language, different ethnicities, and the Somalis have fought against the Ethiopians for hundreds of years. And of course the US didn't appreciate that, and we rolled in there, and that gave root to the Shabab, to the pirates. All this stuff started right then. The famine of 2011, it was all a direct cause of the instability caused by the Americans. And if the US had told Ethiopia, because we give Ethiopia $1 billion a year, if we said, guys, don't go in there, they would not have gone in there. But we were so threatened by these Islamists, just instinctively. And I didn't see the policy change that much from Bush to Obama. So I had this belief, this naive belief, that when Obama came in, because this all started under Bush, that there would be this like enlightened foreign policy in East Africa, and we wouldn't prioritize security and terrorism and military assistance, that we'd be more interested in human rights and democracy. And it really didn't change much. And so bringing it forward, the US cares about Somalia as a counterterrorism problem. They're worried that Shabab is going to train people and send them back here. That's like what's in their head. And so they're supporting the Somali government only to fight terrorism. And it's even more complicated than that. There's a military in Somalia that's basically useless. But the CIA and other agencies of the American government are working with these little elite units that hunt down terrorists. They're not even interested in providing stability or security for the greater country. And so I think under the Trump administration, that's just going to continue. And you're going to see, if the Shabab quiets down or gets defeated or goes away to some degree, you're going to see less and less US military involvement. But if there's another big attack, then it's going to, well, all of a sudden we're going to be interested again in Somalia. And it's really sad because you're never going to get out of that trap if you just look at it that way. These places need leadership. I did a story, actually one of the better stories I did on Somalia, which was a kind of an antidote to a lot of this bad news. It was a few years ago, about a guy from Minneapolis, a Somali refugee named Muhammad Aden. And very interesting guy. He had left the country as a young boy during the height of the Civil War, came to Minnesota, put himself through school, got a bachelor's degree, master's degree in public health, and was running like a healthcare company, home nursing, staffing like home healthcare. Young guy, like 35 years old or something at the time. And when the first famine started to come, there was a big fundraising drive here in Minneapolis to send money, more money, because the remittances from Somalis living in the United States keep that country alive. It's like $2 billion. It's bigger than any other source of income, of industry in Somalia. And this guy got involved, found himself getting more involved, and somebody said to him, hey, maybe you should come back to Somalia and help. And he was from a certain clan, the Saliban clan. So he went back to the Saliban homeland, which is in central Somalia, and he set up a government. And immediately he got support. People have this impression Somalis are chaotic and wild and have no interest in a government. They do have an interest in government. Everybody wants some stability. They don't want their kid to get shot like stepping out of his house. They don't want to be drinking shitty water and worrying about, their family being attacked. And so this guy set up this very rudimentary state that covered, a couple hundred square miles, a couple hundred thousand people. He built some schools, he put up some street lights, he arrested some thieves, and I spent like 2 weeks with him in this, kind of fly-blown area of Somalia, and it was a lesson to me that there was an appetite for authority, just nobody had provided it. And that's the answer for a lot of these places, I think, and Kenya's starting to do it, which is decentralization. Trying to push government down to a local level because it's less controversial, it's less offensive. So if you have a clan government and the leader is your clan, you're more likely to line up behind him. And those nodes, those bases of identity start to fade out when you get to the national level. So many Somalis don't see the president as their leader. He's the guy from another clan, or in Kenya, from another group. And so Kenya's doing this. They're pushing down local government. They're having governors and a lot of local government. And that's gonna change politics in Africa in a good way.
So somebody's
a long answer.
That's okay. But in under 1 minute, somebody says here that you met the leader of the Al-Shabaab.
Yes.
Okay. So they want to, they're asking you, please talk about your meeting with the leader of Al-Shabaab and the impact the West is playing in actually creating terrorism. This person thinks the West has a hand in the terrorism.
I think that question is
short, quick, 1 minute maybe.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was just saying, that we missed an opportunity. We alienated people who were more moderate. It was complicated. There were some bad people in the Shabaab early on that were bent on terrorism, but they were a little piece of a bigger group that was doing some good work. And we just saw terrorism for all of them. And it was just preventable suffering. So I think, yeah, I had a Fanta with this guy. He invited me for a Fanta, we drank a Fanta.
Okay, good. So let's move on to another topic here that is a recurring one. Please, can you discuss, trying to read your writing here. Please, can you discuss or comment on China's influence in Africa? Are their investments beneficial?
That's a good question, and I should work that into my introductory remarks because a lot of people ask that. China is coming into Africa in a big way. It's mostly for minerals and resources. So the Chinese economy is dependent. The whole growth of China is rests on manufacturing. I mean, we all know it. We all have made in China stuff with us in this room. And China's growth and its stability rests on the fact that they're going to be able to keep manufacturing, all the things that they make now. And to do that, they need certain materials. And some of those materials, like copper, are found in Africa in great abundance, or coltan or cobalt, these special minerals that are only found in places in Africa. So China's thinking, it's interesting, they're not a democracy in a way that allows them more vision. So, our politicians have to deliver in 2-year, 4-year cycles. And it's hard to deliver anything like really meaningful or significant in a 2-year or 4-year cycle, but that's our system. China, they don't have to do that. The leaders of China can say, 30 years from now, this investment will pay off. So let's build an enormous highway across Congo or a huge port in Kenya, and we're not going to see a dime from it for 10 or 20 or 30 years. But in 30 years, we will have the monopoly on copper from Congo or oil from South Sudan. And that's how they're thinking. They're thinking way ahead. And you see that across the continent, these huge infrastructure projects. I think some of them are good for Africans. I think in many places, like in Kenya and others, we see better roads and better, you know, infrastructure, airports, ports. But there's this motivation that's different, and it dilutes the power of the West. So even though I complain and others complain that the West should be more human rights focused, we still do have a piece of the State Department that is looking just at human rights. That is still a message that's being transmitted to Africa. Improve human rights, improve free expression, improve freedom of the press. China doesn't even whisper that. They don't do that themselves. So that's the problem, is that as Africa now has another source of sponsorship, another trading partner, another development partner, they can look at us and say, you know what? We don't want to hear your message about human rights because we're going to get this big deal from the Chinese. And it also it goes even deeper that some countries in Africa are trying to develop like China. And they say, hey, you guys in you know, France and England and America, you've been lying to us for all these years because you don't need democracy to grow. Look at China. And they're like, we want to grow like that. We don't care about free expression. We don't care about representative government. We just want to grow and eradicate poverty. And so you're seeing that in places like Ethiopia and Rwanda.
So two questions in one here. So the Chinese are mostly concentrating on infrastructure and mineral extraction, basically. But there's someone here is asking, with the United States reducing their assistance with family planning, for example, do you see the Chinese ever doing something like that, like to step in and help with family planning?
It's a really good question because I was looking at these population charts. China's population is flattening and is going to go down soon, because they took that one-child policy, you know, very seriously. And that was good for the economic development of China. Africa needs more family planning. And a lot of places, they don't have access to contraceptives. They don't know. African women, like, if given the choice, would not choose to have 8 kids. And one strategy is to push back the age at which a woman has a baby for her first baby. Because if she goes to high school, she has a higher chance of having fewer kids than if she didn't go to any school. If she gets, you know, pregnant when she's 13 or 14 or 15, she's probably going to go on and have like 8 or 9 kids. If she gets pregnant for the first time at 20, she'll have 4 or 5 kids. And so there are all these strategies, but the United States is ambivalent about family planning. There is a piece of our government and of the population that does not believe in contraceptives, does not believe in family planning. And so that they, you know, these NGOs that are working on that don't get a lot of support. And it's controversial in the United States. There's even bills that you're not allowed to talk, if you work for the State Department in Kenya, you're not allowed to talk about abortion or family planning because that's seen as advancing your political agenda. So maybe, I had never thought about that, but maybe China would have some credibility to say, you know what, we got ahead of our population problems. Here's how we did it. Places like Rwanda, Malawi, you know, densely populated countries, Nigeria, they're going to have to tackle some of this because there's just not the space for continued population growth.
So I think I'm going to say something on your behalf. You don't claim to be an expert on East Africa. You're just, you know, talking about your experiences and what you're observing. But given that, I'm going to allow this question. That I need a little bit some expert insight, but I'm going to allow it. It says it's about land issues. Somebody is asking, my understanding is there aren't titles to much of land in Eastern Africa, which is true, actually. And Tanzania is mentioned as one of those countries. And that there is an appropriation of land by the state. Is that true? And are there any potential solutions to that? What do you know about land titles in Eastern Africa? And
so it's,
whether the government is appropriating land.
It sounds like kind of a dry, boring issue, but it's very important. So in some parts of Africa, even the idea of like modern title to land is foreign because land was considered communal, and A lot of Africans were swindled in the colonial times, where these, you know, white settlers came and said, "Hey, we want to take this land, this space," and they're like, "Well, nobody really owns it. You know, it's our land, our communal land." They didn't even think of it as like an asset. And the, you know, settlers said, no, let's work something out. Here's some glass beads, or here's some, you know, I don't know, carts or whatever they were using at that time. And the guys would ink their thumbprints on these treaties and just bequeath, like, you know, 50,000 acres, 100,000 acres, huge spaces to individual settlers. And this has come up in Kenya recently because there's movement now to take some of that land back. And it happened in Zimbabwe. They did it really badly. They wanted to take away the land that white people had and give it to indigenous people, because some of these white Zimbabweans were third generation. So you have to then draw a distinction of indigenous versus non-indigenous, because they're all Zimbabwean. They're not you know, foreigners. They're Zimbabwean, like third or fourth generation. So the land issues are heating up, because as the economies grow and as the populations grow, land is becoming more valuable. And there is, the state is interfering in bad ways in many places, where politicians will spot a profitable piece of land and they'll just grab it with state authority, but it's for an individual. And we saw that in Kenya. There was a big story a year or two ago where there was a school that had a playground, like a kind of, you know, ordinary elementary school, sort of one-story building, you know, maybe a few lights, not a lot of electricity, no computers, wooden desks, you know, very sort of simple, traditional type school. And next to it was a nice playground. The kids would play in at recess. And then near that were some hotels. And that area was becoming more valuable. And one day, these bulldozers showed up, and they just tried to take the playground. And this is a state, I mean, this is not a private school. This is a public Kenyan government school. And the vice president was trying to grab the playground to build a hotel. And this one activist in Nairobi mobilized all these people. These kids got tear gassed, like these little students, you've seen the video, got tear gassed. This girl like passed out. Nobody was seriously hurt, but it was like, what the hell is going on? And it caused such a ruckus that they had to kind of retreat. And the playground, rest assured, is intact. But it just showed there's like this frenzy. That's what you're seeing with a lot of the development. It's frenzy. It's not planned out. It's like, let's put them all here. Let's put a highway here. You know, let's put a hotel here. You know, there's no zoning. There's no vision. It's happening too fast, and it's becoming permanent. You know, they're laying down these roads. They're not building trains. Like Nairobi, the traffic is horrible, and it's going to get worse. Every day, there's some excited Kenyan who just bought a Toyota Corolla for $5,000 and is hitting the road, pumped to be the owner of a car. And he, every day, there's 50 of them, 100 of them. And it's just, so the traffic is going to get worse. And none of these, Ethiopia was the only country to build a mass transit, a train. And Ethiopia is very repressive, not democratic at all. But they're decent with development. It's like the Chinese model, top-down, state-controlled economy. And they were the first ones to say, the only answer is a mass transit system. But in Kenya, it's crying out for that. And the World Bank and donors would be more than happy for environmental reasons, job productivity, and nobody's doing it.
Okay, another two questions in one. So in Nairobi, there are a lot of you guys from the West residing in Nairobi, involved in many aid activities in the region. Would you say how can you describe these aid agencies that are operating from Nairobi, that entire region? Is their impact positive? I'm just paraphrasing. Is their impact positive, or as one person put it in a question, yeah, are they just enjoying a good salary in Nairobi and just...
No, I'm just curious. Can you read the question?
Yeah, so... I said I was paraphrasing, but here is one. In what countries outside Africa influence it? I don't know, they just put countries in brackets, Kenya, Congo, Tanzania. Why are all these people in Africa?
So the aid is like a huge controversial subject, and I'm not going to do it justice in a couple quick, you know, sentences. But some aid works really well. Some aid, especially health aid, works really well. It's saving lives. Like, for instance, Kenya receives nearly $1 billion a year now in foreign aid. I think several hundred million dollars is just for medicine. And a lot of that is for antiretroviral drugs for people who have AIDS or HIV positive. And that's keeping millions of people alive, just this infusion of pharmaceutical from the United States. And that's like a huge chunk of aid. So that aid, I don't see how you can argue with that aid. Otherwise, those people would perish if they couldn't afford those drugs. There's a bigger conversation. Maybe the drugs should be cheaper or, you know, a public resource, but they're not. These pharmaceutical companies spend a lot of money investing and developing those drugs, and they need to sell them. So we spend a lot of money on medicine. That stuff works. The malaria treatment, you know, you used to get malaria. I mean, I got malaria. People get malaria, and if you get treatment quickly, you will be fine, or mostly fine. And that's saving lots of lives. There's a new thing now with cash. It's very interesting. So in the Somali famine, the new solution now is just to send money into famine areas and let people go to their local stores with like a credit card that you can send in money from overseas. They take that credit card to like a little shop, you know, picture like a little metal kiosk with a metal roof and kind of a chain link fence where the sort of blocking off people so they can't get into the shop, and the shopkeeper's behind there with some sacks of grain and some oil and some salt and some sugar. And people go there with their card, and they equip these shopkeepers with the little card reader, and they buy the food that they need that way. And it makes so much more sense than, you know, growing the food here, shipping it through Mombasa, bringing it in through aid trucks, all the admin that takes. Some of the food may ultimately come from the United States, but the idea is let these Somali merchants figure out how to meet the demand and empower people, empower the local economy, empower local farmers. They might then be incentivized if they can make more money growing food. You know, if you bring in all this food from outside, that just eviscerates the local economy. And somebody's like, how can I compete with this, you know, these sacks of grain being unloaded by the boatload? You know, how am I going to meet that demand as a local farmer? So, and this is even going now to development. So in some areas in Western Kenya, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there's this like cash, there's like NGOs that just send cash. So a non-emergency situation, they'll go into a rural area and say, what do you guys need? Is it a solar panel? Is it a better borehole for cleaner water? Is it school uniforms? Is it another goat so you can increase your productivity on your farm? And instead of sort of stealing what the people will do, they just give them money. And the belief is, you know, they do studies and they try to identify people that are responsible, and there is follow-up. But the idea is just give them money. They will figure out what they need better than we will, and it will be a lot less, you know, overhead. There is these issues of creating dependence. You know, if you just keep giving out handouts, then nobody's going to be incentivized to work. But a lot of people just need a start. Like I was in Kisumu a couple weeks back, and this family had bought a solar panel for $70.
Kisumu is in Western Kenya, for those who don't know.
And the family bought a solar panel for $70, but they couldn't afford that. They had to pay it back over a year. So just they'd sell a few eggs or maybe, you know, some produce from their farm, little each week, just get a little money to pay back that solar panel. Their kids were studying at night. They had light. For the first time, from a $70 solar panel, it totally transformed the education of those children. I remember being in Eastern Congo at a place where there was like no development, a very, you know, bombed out, shot up town, where there was no working electricity, no, you know, functioning roads, and the only development was at a United Nations peacekeeping base. And at night, the peacekeeping base had these huge lights, like stadium lights, and there were these children that were sitting at little desks at the gates of the peacekeeping base, sitting, writing, reading, studying. It was only light for hundreds of miles. And these huge clouds of termites and bugs that were you know, swarming around the lights. But it was like, you know, that was all they needed to just get a step up. So I think aid is very complicated, but I am seeing some new approaches that I think have a lot of promise.
Here's a follow-up question related to aid. A lot of these countries have a zero tolerance for GMO foods, yet their children are malnourished. Can you speak to the GMO policies in the that you might be familiar with in the region? Good or bad, or what have you seen now? Is that evolving? Is there a possibility they might accept GMO foods? The people I know from where I grow, where I grew up, they don't want to hear anything about GMO foods. I mean, these are folks who are used to, you know, organic food, basically. So what's your take on that?
I will be faking it if I go too deep on this. Because I don't know too much, but I do know there's like this knee-jerk reaction to, you know, genetically modified foods. That's what that is. I don't know. I mean, what's nice about living in Africa is a lot of the food is fresh. You go to a restaurant, you order a hamburger and fries. It might take an hour, but somebody's in the back like peeling the potatoes. You know, everything tastes like fresh. And it's the whole farm-to-table thing is, you know, kind of laughable. That's how people operate. So I think there is like a built-in expectation and loyalty to locally grown, naturally grown foods, and a suspicion of anything that's created outside of that. But a lot of this is just misinformation. Just people haven't really. They're reacting to something their government put out. There may be an anti-Western piece to it. They see it as some conspiracy that we're dumping on them food that we don't eat ourselves. You know, would you guys remember the Nestle baby milk? I remember like being a 7-year-old kid with my mom in a grocery store in Evanston, Illinois, and there was like a woman that was like, "Don't buy Nestle," and I learned the word boycott at that moment. And like, it's crazy. I always associate Nestle with that. That they were giving out what I guess the scandal was, they knew the baby formula was expired or not good, and they still were exporting it. So, you know, there's a history here. It's not totally imagined that the West is giving them inferior products.
Okay, somebody's commending you for that you say. First, it's amazing that you get to bring Africa to America using journalism. What do you suggest for Americans or Africans in the diaspora and their role in Africa? How can we use our skill set or passions to bring exposure to Africa, about Africa, to the United States?
I would say subscribe to the New York Times and buy my book.
And for those who are very into what is really happening in East Africa, there's a lot been going on to Tanzania. Tanzania is in your coverage area. What can you tell us is going on in Tanzania, especially with the new president, a new approach? There is a certain freshness that he has brought to governance. You talked about governance briefly. What have you had a chance to visit Tanzania recently since the new president took over?
I have. I love Tanzania. Tanzania and Kenya are very similar in many ways, but they've gone in different directions since independence. Tanzania flirted with socialism, and its economy remains behind. Kenya is much more dynamic, much more development. You meet Kenyans running, and I'm not just saying this because you guys are here, but you meet Kenyans in Juba, South Sudan, and you know in Kampala, all over the region, running businesses because the just professional class is much deeper in Kenya. And Tanzania is a bit, things are slower there. But one thing that Tanzania did, which was really enviable and wonderful, was they de-emphasized tribe. And the first president of Tanzania in the 60s said, biggest threat to our stability is identifying with our tribe. We are a weak, new nation state, and we have to feel like we're Tanzanian. And to do that, he mandated the use of Swahili. It was like busing with schools and segregation. They took kids from different parts of the country and they sent them to different areas to go to high school so they would break those bonds between people in their native areas. Because tribe and geography go together. You know, that's how it works. It's not like there are different people of different tribes that are all mixed together. It's usually there's one place that's predominated by this group and another place next to it by a different group and a different group. That's how most of the world is. So Tanzania got some things right and has been spared the turmoil of many African countries. It's never had a moment like Kenya had in 2007-2008. It's been spared that. It's a beautiful, peaceful country, but it's behind. And there is a new president who is kind of a strong man. He's showing some dictatorial, you know, tendencies where, you know, it's his road or the high road, and he's you know, arresting people. He was banning, actually, American aid to gay groups and trying to cut supplies of antiretroviral drugs to people with HIV because he doesn't like gay people, and just sort of mandated that, like, overnight. So there's, you know, in a way, he's you know, he's got good and bad, but I think Tanzania has unlocked the secret to stability that a lot of African countries need, which is to create this sense of nation and identity. And that's, like, for somebody who studied Swahili, I love going to Tanzania because it's just Swahili everywhere. Whereas in Kenya, you walk down the street and I've been there long enough, I can hear Kikuyu, I can hear Luo, people, you know, will use their native language, their tribal tongues to each other. In Tanzania, you never hear that.
Should we wrap that up? Can we go some more?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So we have a question. So we'll go. There's a question here about, since you've mentioned Kenya, somebody asking a question here. You already mentioned Ethiopia and the involvement in Somalia, but you haven't talked about Kenya's involvement in Somalia and how that has contributed to some of the chaos that we still have there.
No, I'm glad you brought that up. The world's largest refugee camp is in northern Kenya. And it is it's basically like a one-story city of 500,000 people called Dadaab. And Dadaab became this reservoir of people coming from Somalia, fleeing the civil war, who came in the 1990s, who came then in the early 2000s, who have kept coming as Somalia sort of struggles to find its way. And it's a very dry area. It's basically the desert, very thorny, very hot, very dusty. And people make these temporary shelters out of sticks, and they cover them with fabric, or maybe they have a tent given to them by UNICEF or an aid group. And you just, if you climb up on a water tower at Dadaab and get a vantage point, because it's just perfectly flat, you can just see this endless expanse of these little shelters just going on and on and on. And for a lot of people, that's survival. You know, that's better than what they would have faced back in Somalia. The Kenyan government has been threatening to close the camp and drive everybody out back into Somalia. And they keep threatening. Then they run into resistance from the donors who say, we're not going to pay for that. You're not allowed to do that. Kenya has signed on to these UN treaties that recognize refugees, and if you've gone through the process and you're deemed to have fled your native country because of conflict or persecution, you're considered a refugee. And any country that's signed on to that treaty has to recognize these refugees with certain rights. Kenya's part of that. And so the international community has said, like, well, you can't just kick these people out. But there's a very anti-Somali feeling in Kenya. Because of these terrorist attacks, because of the Shabab, they have struck in Kenya. They've killed hundreds, if not 1,000 people in Kenya. It's the easiest place to strike against a Western target. And Kenya made the mistake of trying to intervene in Somalia, sending its own troops across the border, and they've done like a pretty shitty job. They've stolen you know, money. They've run this racket where they're chopping down these forests and selling the charcoal. So it's an environmental problem, corruption problem. There isn't like a lot on it in the Kenyan press because people are scared to write about it. And they've also exposed their troops to, you know, the generals and the higher ups in the military and the government have left these like troops out in the middle of nowhere with little food, little water, little defense. And there's been several instances of the Shabab surrounding these camps and just wiping out hundreds of Kenyan soldiers, you know, in a few hours. and videotaping it, and it's like outrageous. Kenyan government won't even say how many people got killed. They'll deny it at first. I get these releases as a journalist. This one attack happened in January last year. Press release goes out. No, that was misinformation. It was not a Kenyan camp. It was a Somali military camp. Our troops are fine. A few hours later, the Shabab released this video showing them blowing away these Kenyans, bodies everywhere, pictures of the bodies, you know, and eventually, like, people like me and other journalists get the information out that these guys got just wasted. And so the government of Kenya was kind of playing around in Somalia, and again, there's like no strategy. And so it's leaving Kenya exposed, because their military should be fighting these guys. Instead, they're getting ambushed and killed. And then instead of actually fighting them, they're running these rackets to steal and smuggle. And then they take it out on these refugees that are living in the desert and say, you guys are the problem. So I think that's going to be an issue that we're gonna have to keep watching.
Okay, unless there's another question coming on the Kurds, this might be our last question. Africa is based on an oral culture. What is the future of the printed word? Or I guess I can say written word. You mentioned, no Somali was written until Somali 1974.
I think with the Facebook and internet and mobile phones, you're seeing a lot more people reading and engaged. I think that's going to spread throughout. Even taxi drivers are on Facebook now. It's like everybody's on this stuff. I think it might be a danger to local languages, because people are going to communicate in English predominantly on these forums. I mean, there is some like Swahili that you see, but not a lot. And I think you're going to see more and more emphasis on English.
I don't want to take you back to Tanzania, but this is a very detailed question here.
So the last question.
Yeah, so the last question. So I wasn't aware of this, I have to confess. So Tanzania recently had an issue with Acacia Gold Mining Company. Acacia taking gold and minerals out of Tanzania while bribing the government. Same way with Zambia and others. Basically, this person is asking, what is the corruption and the mineral extraction that is happening in that region?
This is a big problem. So these resource economies, it does not benefit the people. There's like a proven track record of a country that gets oil, it actually does not improve the economy by any substantial measure, and leads to corruption and instability, because the extractive industries are not good for most people. They poison the environment. The government cuts deals with these foreign companies. They pay the workers and the miners very little. And nobody's learning. It's not like the tourism industry. Tourism is actually a very good industry for a lot of these countries, because it employs all types. It employs CEOs, it employs pilots, it employs white-collar people and accountants, and then safari guides and skilled labor, and then unskilled labor, you know, making the beds in the hotel rooms or cutting the grass at the hotel. So tourism is like a great industry. But these extractive industries, it's like the governments will cut these deals to make a few people very rich, and then nobody else benefits. And they are eating into wildlife parks, like in Tanzania. They've already cut into the Serengeti for a uranium mine. It's like this very short-sighted calculation, because they're not interested in economic development. They're just trying to get like that sort of finder's fee of landing the deal, and then they don't care. So I could talk all night. So
yes.
Thank you, everybody, for the question all night. So.
Just a quick. Thank you. So I've read the book. I have 60 pages to go. It's 360 some pages. So I've read 300, close to 300, 280 something actually. So I have a few pages to go. But it's a great book. Please get it. He's going to sign copies outside. I'm going to ask your indulgence. If somebody tells you they need to go, it's about 7 o'clock. They need to go for prayer maybe around 8 o'clock. You know, it's Ramadan. So around 8 o'clock, whoever is here might need to go for prayer at 8 before they do the iftar. So when he's signing books, feel free to let the person go ahead and sign. They're not jumping the line. Just be kind. Okay. All right. Thank you so much for letting me moderate the session. We'll see you later.